From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's Donald Rumsfeld versus George Tenet, the Department of Defense versus the CIA, a full-on turf war over who will be top dog in American intelligence. The Pentagon now controls the majority of the $38 billion U.S. intelligence budget and is reaching for even greater influence over America's spy operations. CIA loyalists are crying foul. Intelligence gathering must be independent, they say, and free from military manipulation. In this hour, Washington's intelligence brawl, who's responsible for keeping America safe? We begin tonight with news of an intelligence report that Islamic extremists affiliated with Al-Qaeda have smuggled a chemical weapon from Iraq out through Turkey. If the report is confirmed, it would be the hardest evidence yet to support the president's charge that global terrorists have received material assistance from Iraq. It's the kind of report that could be presented as a cause for war. Washington Post reporter Barton Gellman broke the story. Earlier, I asked him to describe the report.
It's a credible intelligence report. It's not corroborated by second and third sources. And it says that an Islamic extremist group connected to Al-Qaeda has obtained some quantity of chemical weapon in Iraq and is believed to have smuggled it out through the northern border into Turkey.
What is the group? Is it Al-Qaeda directly? What's the affiliation?
The group is called Asfar al-Ansar. It is Sunni extremists, many of them Palestinian, formerly based in Lebanon and lately having set up shop in northern Iraq. They are sort of signatories to various fatwas under the Al-Qaeda network. You know, when bin Laden says it's a duty for everyone to kill Americans there in the list of small print at the bottom. And they get money from Al-Qaeda, but they are not known to do everything they do specifically on Al-Qaeda's behalf.
And the chemical that is reportedly or has reportedly been taken out of Iraq by this group is the VX nerve agent. Remind us what VX is and why is that believed to be the chemical?
The analysts are less confident that it's VX, or that is to say it's an analytical conclusion that it may be VX, rather than that they have very specific intelligence saying it is. VX is the most potent chemical weapon in Iraq's arsenal, or for that matter, anyone else's. It's a nerve agent, which means it kills you by stopping your breathing and putting you in convulsions. And what makes it potent is that you need less of it to kill someone than you do with other agents.
Interestingly, of course, the UN weapons inspectors in their final report on their last go-round in Iraq in 1999 said they could not account for a ton and a half of VX. Is that a little or a lot? How much does it take to be lethal to a significant number of people if you're talking about terrorism on a large scale?
Well, I think you would be dead after a small fraction of a teaspoon, let's put it that way. So when you're talking about 1.5 tons, it's potentially a lot of people. You can never get anything close to perfectly efficient delivery, thank God, but a lot of VX would kill a lot of people.
Barton Gellman, of course, coming right now, both the timing and the source of news of this report are extremely interesting. The source, first of all, to the extent that you can, under whatever strictures you're reporting, what is the source of this information?
Well, the interesting thing is everyone naturally assumes that it's Iraq war hawks in the Bush administration who want to make the case for going after Iraq. Mm-hmm. In fact, the information came to me from officials that I've known for some time who are not particularly concerned with Iraq but are concerned about chemical weapons or concerned about Al-Qaeda, and they have no strong opinions about whether we ought to have a war with Iraq. They're in kind of a just-the-facts-please mode.
Of course, it's possible to float hot potato report like this up through disinterested parties. You make a reference to a Defense Intelligence Agency report that recently came out on the Turkish defense front. What is that report, and what's the relationship between that report and this news?
Well, it's a good question. The report is, and I know this is true, the Defense Intelligence Agency put out what they call a threat message, and it said that there seem to be elevated risk of a chemical weapons attack against the air base in Incirlik in southern Turkey. Now, it coincides with new information that a chemical agent may have been smuggled out of Iraq and to that very neighborhood in southern Turkey. However, I don't have any knowledge that that warning is connected with the intelligence report that I'm writing about today. It could be coincidence.
Is there CIA activity related to this report of chemical weapons coming out of Iraq and into the hands of terrorists?
Well, yeah, the CIA and every other relevant U.S. government agency is aggressively pursuing this lead. And one way that you can tell that the government takes it seriously is that, you know, sort of 99% of all the hundreds and hundreds of scraps of threat information they get put sort of in the discard pile or the let's think about that later pile. But this one is being treated as sort of in the top 1% of interest. So they are devoting new resources to trying to find out who might have taken this chemical weapon, what exactly the weapon is, how big, where it went, where they hope to use it, and they're working hard to find those things out.
If this report should be somehow confirmed, and I'm not sure how that would ever happen, would this, you're hearing response, I'm sure, from Bush administration people today to your story, would this constitute a cause for war?
I think that they intend to make their case at a time of their choosing and with the facts that they think are going to be most persuasive. They did not want to talk about this story, and I suppose that the reason is that they are never going to be willing to display the evidence. The report came from what's described to me as a highly sensitive and credible source, but it's the sort of source that they're never going to make public. So they're going to be looking for other evidence that they can make public, you know, in the fashion of the Adlai Stevenson in the UN showing the satellite photos of the Cuban missiles back in the 1960s. So I don't think this is going to be the casus belli, but it may stiffen their resolve.
Martin, I wonder if you have any fear in the sensitive position you're in as a reporter here that you're part of a campaign to soften the public up, the world up, and prepare it for war. Or are you absolutely confident that this is a genuine report that came to you in a disinterested fashion? Or can one ever know?
There's no perfect knowledge. I ask myself and ask my sources and spend a lot of time trying to probe exactly this question. And I did more than we're normally able to do in a story like this to display the provenance of the story.
Yes, you did.
And you have to, you know, a reader can choose to believe or not believe. This is the most I can say, is that I got the story independently. No one came to me with it. It actually happened to be on the periphery of something else I was already reporting. They were not Iraq partisans. And when I went to the White House expecting them to say, oh, yes, you should know about this, their spin was, we really don't want to talk about this. And I do not believe that this was a conspiracy to float the idea through a disinterested party.
But if it's confirmed, this could be the smoking gun, the evidence of a connection between Iraq and international terrorism and frightening international terrorism. Martin Gellman, thanks for your story and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Martin Gellman is a reporter with The Washington Post. He spoke with me earlier today from Washington. Since 9/11, the Pentagon has deepened its grip on U.S. intelligence operations and fallen in line with the administration's push for war with Iraq. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld is now set to appoint a new Undersecretary for Intelligence next year. It's a new chapter in a long-running turf war in the American intelligence community between the CIA, FBI, and Department of Defense. The DOD appears to be winning. But is that good for American security, for the reliability and independence of American intelligence? Are we getting a clear and honest view of the world from our vast intelligence apparatus? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight from Denver, Colorado, is Admiral Stansfield Turner. He was director of the CIA from 1977 to 1981 and is a senior research scholar at the Center for International and Security Studies at the University of Maryland. Good evening and welcome, Admiral Stansfield Turner.
Good evening. Delighted to be with you.
Wonderful to have you. Also with us tonight from Washington is Melvin Goodman, Senior Policy Fellow at the Center for International Policy. He was a Soviet analyst with the CIA from 1966 to 1986. Good evening and welcome, Melvin Goodman.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. And hi, Stan.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Melvin.
Good to have you both with us. Stansfield Turner, we're reading all these reports of tension between these giant intelligence operations, and we're not sure if and how we've got a dog in this fight. Why does it matter to American citizens, to the country, where the locus of or control of American intelligence work is?
During the Cold War, there was an excuse for keeping the locusts in the Defense Department because good intelligence is utterly vital to military operations. Hmm. Now, our primary threat is terrorism. The response to that threat is only partially a military response. Therefore, the control over intelligence must be in the national interest of defeating terrorism. That's not a military issue. That's not something the military should control.
But, Melvin Goodman, we read, we hear that, in fact, control is shifting ever deeper into the Department of Defense. Why is that happening?
Well, I think it's happening for a variety of reasons, and it's been happening for the past 10 years. First of all, you have to look at the CIA as a beleaguered organization. It had problems in supplying intelligence during Desert Storm, which really angered the military. There was the failure to track the demise and collapse of the Soviet Union. And then, of course, there was the Aldridge Ames espionage case. Mm-hmm. This weakened the CIA as an institution. Meanwhile, the Pentagon, I think, has won over a lot of confidence on the Hill and with the American people. And I think they see this great vulnerability. The Pentagon was never in favor of the creation of the CIA in 1947 in the first place. And in the past 10 years, they've gradually, with salami tactics, taken over a lot of areas of intelligence that the CIA used to play major roles in, and now with creation of an Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, they're setting up their own intelligence shop. Mm. This is not a good thing. I agree with Stan, because I think Harry Truman made it clear that intelligence should be done by a non-policy agency. The Pentagon, of course, is a major policy player.
Describe exactly what you mean by that. It makes policy in regard to war and military operations, whereas the CIA is supposed to be just serving up intelligence without an agenda?
The CIA should provide intelligence that should be free of any policy bias. It cannot engage in policy advocacy. It has to provide intelligence with the bark on. If it's a message the president doesn't want to hear, well, so be it, which was the case during Vietnam, when the CIA had a much different view of our progress than certainly the Pentagon did or the White House did. The Pentagon is much different. It's a policy agency. It uses intelligence to support its budget. Its budget now is at record peacetime levels, $355 billion a year and growing. I think it's skewing intelligence on Iraq's military capabilities, and I think on the Iraq-Al-Qaeda connection. That's why this report by Barton Gellman, who's an outstanding reporter, nevertheless, this is a very suspect report coming at this particular time.
And we talked with him about the providence of it. Stan Chiltuner, you sat right at the top of the CIA. Now we've got this greater, and perhaps when you were in the CIA was the peak of the CIA's power in the kind of turf war here. Do you really believe that the Department of Defense itself is vulnerable to producing corrupt intelligence, which is essentially what I hear Melvin Goodman suggesting?
No question about it whatsoever. I watched it all the time I was there. If you're a lieutenant general in charge of one of the Defense Department's intelligence agencies, your future hinges on the kind of intelligence you produce and whether or not it supports the policies of the Department of Defense.
But as you said, bad intelligence doesn't win wars. Why would any military operation want to put forward a distorted picture of the world?
No. The military want to use that intelligence to support their budgets on Capitol Hill. And if you, in the intelligence world, produce a report that says, we don't need any more tanks because the opponent doesn't have any good tanks, why, you're in real trouble because the Army, the military, want to buy more tanks. So you have to be very cautious if you're a chief of a military intelligence agency that you don't run counter too strongly to the policies of the Department of Defense. This change that they're talking about today, a joint congressional committee which has recommended a change in this structure to give more authority to the Director of Central Intelligence, is a very important one, and one that we've got to get into the national debate here.
We'll come right back and talk about it, Stan Chiltuner. Stay with us. We're talking about a high-stakes turf war in America's intelligence community and how it's shaping, maybe warping, America's view of the world. Do you know who's guiding America's spies? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a high-stakes turf war in Washington in the middle of America's intelligence community and how it's shaping, maybe warping, America's view of the world. My guests tonight are Admiral Stansfield Turner. He was director of the CIA from 1977 to 1981. And Melvin Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a former Soviet analyst with the CIA from 1966 to 1986. You can join us as well. Are you confident that the U.S. government is getting honest, unbiased, complete intelligence? Can you imagine intelligence reports being spun, being shaped to support preconceived agendas? Can you imagine? 1-800-423-8255. Stansfield Turner, you mentioned just before the break the joint congressional panel that came out with a recommendation of an intelligence czar. Now, you've probably looked at this more closely than I. We all heard that they said you've got to have one person independent at the top, cabinet level, in charge of American intelligence. But I wasn't so clear that that was to be the head of the CIA.
It is not. The law of 1947 that created the CIA also created another position called the Director of Central Intelligence. That position was to coordinate the 14 separate intelligence agencies that we have in our country today.
Mm-hmm.
That's a separate job from running the CIA. And when I was the director of Central Intelligence, President Carter instructed me to put my major effort on being director of Central Intelligence and leaving to my deputy the job of running the CIA. That is, the director of Central Intelligence position was to coordinate those 14 agencies and make sure we were all moving in the same direction, marching to the same tune.
But from the Pentagon's point of view, you must have then, and the Pentagon must see today, that the director of Central Intelligence is, however you slice it, effectively also the head of the CIA, which they see as a competitor, I guess.
That's correct. And for 15 years now, I've been recommending we separate these two jobs, and that's exactly what the Congressional Committee has now recommended. They've changed the name from Director of Central Intelligence to the Director of National Intelligence, but basically they're saying separate these two positions, have one individual who runs the entire organization, the 14 different agencies, make sure they coordinate well, and another one who runs just one of those agencies, the CIA.
Melvin Goodman, do you think that would be a step in the right direction, and why? What's at stake here?
Well, there's a lot at stake. Honest intelligence is clearly at stake here, and without honest intelligence, you're not going to win the war on terrorism, because I agree with Stan, this is not a job for military power, it's a job for intelligence and law enforcement. But one thing must be kept in mind. You can create an intelligence czar, you can have a director for national intelligence, but until you weaken the military's control on the intelligence community, which General Scowcroft wants to do, and he wrote a sensitive report recommending that, and it's been put on a shelf because Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld didn't approve of it, you're not going to change anything. You have to remember that the Pentagon controls at least 80%, maybe 85 to 90% of the intelligence budget, and the same proportion of the personnel who work in the intelligence community.
The Pentagon controls, I want to be sure I heard that right, 80 to 90% of the U.S. intelligence budget?
Exactly. When Stan talks about 14 intelligence agencies, remember, only the CIA is independent of the Pentagon. Most of the other agencies are part of military intelligence directly, whether it's the Coast Guard or the various services or the Defense Intelligence Agency, or they're combat support agencies.
Well, then the CIA it sounds like the CIA is already a little stepbrother here. It's only 10% or less.
That is exactly the problem. It is a stepbrother. And until you have a director of national intelligence who can conduct oversight of the intelligence community and the budgets, who can move personnel between the elements of the intelligence community, who can name the priorities of the intelligence community. Let me give you a good example of an intelligence failure that was important that took place in 1998, and that was the Indian nuclear test failure, which never should have happened. One of the reasons why that took place...
This is when India held a nuclear test. The United States had no heads up that it was coming.
Nuclear test, and the CIA learned from CNN about these tests. And part of the problem was the military had not prioritized satellite collection of intelligence over India or South Asia. And there's a good reason for that. The Pentagon wasn't interested in South Asia, and the Pentagon has never been interested in arms control. So here was a strategic interest of the United States with a comprehensive test ban treaty at stake, and with this intelligence failure, you got the failure to ratify the comprehensive test ban treaty. And I blame the military's control over strategic intelligence directly for that intelligence failure.
Stansfield Turner, you say that the preponderance of Pentagon control over intelligence gathering may also interrupt or handicap America's effort to deal with terrorism. Give us a sense materially of how or why that's the case.
Today, for instance, you have to get a priority for what you're going to collect in intelligence about Iraq. There's a conflict between collecting intelligence on how we're going to invade Iraq and whether Iraq is in fact conforming to the United Nations mandates about weapons of mass destruction. You can't necessarily do them both simultaneously. For instance, a photographic satellite passing over Iraq this afternoon can only take pictures of one or the other. Somebody's got to select that priority. Obviously, if you give that authority to the Department of Defense, they're going to take the one about invading Iraq. It may well be, however, that we ought to concentrate our efforts today on finding out whether there really are weapons of mass destruction in that country.
It makes it sound as though you're saying it's the old aphorism, to a hammer, everything looks like a nail. To the military, everything looks like a war possibility, and our intelligence is getting drawn into supporting that view of the world. But on the other hand, Melvin Goodman, you and Admiral Turner both come out of CIA backgrounds. Are you just defending the home turf here? I mean, the CIA has not exactly got an unblemished record, as you've said.
The CIA has been blameworthy here as well. I look at this whole problem in Iraq as starting in 1998 when the CIA infiltrated the United Nations inspection teams. And CIA clandestine operators were involved with the inspection teams trying to collect intelligence against Saddam Hussein. Well, just as the military puts emphasis on the Iraqi military and order of battle, the CIA was putting too much emphasis on collection against Saddam Hussein and his vulnerability. The important thing here, and I agree with Stan again, is the UN resolutions, observing the UN resolutions, and is Saddam Hussein violating the UN resolutions. This is the key international issue right now.
Rather than perhaps searching for a trigger to war. Stansfield Turner, Melvin Goodman, stand by. Callers want to join us. David is on the line. Welcome, David. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. How are you tonight?
Fine, thanks.
I think the Admiral, his experience and his instincts are exactly correct. But I would like to ask him and your other guest if they don't think we need a new model for intelligence gathering and analysis.
David, I'm going to let it go at that. Your phone's pretty rough for us. Stansfield Turner, is there a new model, or are you wanting to turn back to an older model?
No, we need a new model, and that's a model where we do have one individual, a director of national intelligence, as they're now calling it, who sets the priorities for the entire intelligence community and coordinates them to make sure they get carried out. And the Congressional Committee has recommended 7 specific authorities be given to that director of national intelligence to enable him or her to exercise those authorities. And that's very important that those particular authorities that the committee recommends be given in order to empower the director of national intelligence to do something really meaningful here in bringing all these agencies together.
So the heart of the new model is getting it out of the turf war dynamic and placing someone with a great deal of authority in a high enough position that he or she can oversee the entire terrain.
That's correct, and that one person has got to be the director of national intelligence who reports directly to the president of the United States and therefore can represent the overall national interest in this debate, rather than the military's interest or the State Department's interest or the Treasury Department's interest or whosoever.
I want to welcome another voice into our conversation. Frank Anderson is joining us tonight from Rockville, Maryland. He was Near East Bureau Chief for the CIA from 1991 to 1994. Good evening and welcome, Frank Anderson.
Good evening to you, and good evening, Admiral Turner and Mel.
Frank. Hello, Frank.
Frank Anderson, you, I understand, are working on a program to evaluate intelligence post 9/11 for the Department of Defense. What do you make of this long-running turf war that's really heated up again? Is the Department of Defense muzzling? Is it trumping in a damaging way the CIA?
Well, I don't know if it's in a damaging way. historically, and maybe it's just a factor of human nature, all fights in Washington ultimately become turf fights, or all issues in some way become turf fights. I'm less concerned than either Admiral Turner or Mel about the likely impact of this one for the following reasons. Notwithstanding any organizational changes, and there were some very important ones. Mel has pointed them out in the last 10 years, particularly during the tenure of DCI Deutsch, in an effort to move functions that had been performed by the CIA into organizations that are either shared with or completely controlled by the Department of Defense.
This is John Deutsch, former head of the CIA.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But all this has to be put in the context that it is still the Director of Central Intelligence who's the man who meets every morning with the president. And he is able to certainly express the view of the CIA in those meetings in ways that no one else in Washington can do.
Well, he may, but I don't think Donald Rumsfeld has any lack of access to President Bush. And if Donald Rumsfeld has maybe 90% of the intelligence budget, isn't that a trumping factor? Does that push our national, our government view of the world toward a kind of perpetual war footing if the view is coming out of the DOD?
Well, the problem is greater than that. The change that John Deutsch made that was so reprehensible was in 1996, and that's when you took the analysis of satellite collection, our most sensitive means of collecting intelligence through satellite photography, and you gave that to the Pentagon, to the National Reconnaissance Office, and the National Imagery and Mapping Agency. This was once done by an office in the CIA and a shared office, the National Photographic Interpretation Center, shared between the CIA and the military. Now the military is the sole authority on satellite photography that then is used to justify which weapons we build, how high the defense budget should be, and what is the likelihood of threat leading to confrontation and then American involvement.
Why would the CIA give that up? Why would any director of the CIA give up that capacity?
Personally, I think John Deutsch gave it up because at that time he was CIA director and was expecting to become the Secretary of Defense, and he thought he would inherit it. But remember, the CIA was a very vulnerable organization, as I said earlier, because of the Ames espionage, because of the failure on the Soviet Union, because of a series of intelligence failures that took place, particularly the lack of good support for Desert Storm and the military's anger with the CIA over very inefficient collection of military intelligence to help the warfighter.
But Melvin Goodman, none of that would powerfully suggest that we want to shift the pendulum back to the CIA, does it, on its face? These are all failures.
You have to send it back to a CIA that has reformed, that has gotten more involved in strategic intelligence, that has gotten more expertise in areas that have nothing to do with the Cold War. My problem in terms of a model is we're still working with a Cold War model on how we do business in the intelligence world. And the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union and the collapse of the Warsaw Pact has not changed our thinking. We have to disenthrall ourselves of that old era. This is a much different world we're living in, and I don't think the CIA has caught up to it.
Tom, if I could add, I don't
Central
think
Turner.
I don't think it's a question of the CIA versus the Pentagon. I think it's a question of who is going to coordinate all these activities. You can't have 14 separate agencies out there all doing intelligence, spending something like $30 billion a year of our tax money, and nobody in charge. Nobody saying the priority today is this. Nobody saying, oh, look, if you've collected that, that means that somebody else should be collecting this. And unless we put somebody in overall charge, it just runs in different directions on without real purpose.
And 9/11 says we can't afford that. Debbie's on the line. Welcome, Debbie. You're on the air.
You have to say goodbye to Anderson.
Oh, I'm sorry. I guess I don't have Debbie for the moment. Frank Anderson, a last thought from you. You're consulting to the Department of Defense. But I don't hear a concern on your part. Your fellow guests are saying we need the kind of honest broker intermediary that the CIA represents ultimately to be sure that a defense policy agenda and bias doesn't get into our intelligence. It makes a kind of native sense, but you don't buy it?
Well, I buy it in a philosophical sense. I would say currently I'm not as concerned as either Admiral Turner or Mel. I remain persuaded following. The DCI does have unique access. He does have a unique role and has a unique agency beneath him. And I have to say I disagree with Mel on the degree to which the agency may have failed to catch up, or for that matter, the rest of the U.S. government to the post-World Cold War era. And in these circumstances, the issue of the agency versus the Department of Defense usually falls, as Mel said before, on the performance of the agency. When you've got a CIA that is performing well, that CIA has special access to the president and to the policymakers, including the Secretary of Defense.
Of course, when the Department of Defense has 90% of the budget, that may have something to do with who's performing. Frank Anderson, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
You're quite welcome.
I think I've got Debbie on the line now. Welcome, Debbie. You're on the air.
I have a couple of questions, a couple of comments.
Mm-hmm.
The first relates to the fact that I think there really needs to be a consolidation of effort, and logically what follows after that is a consolidation of funding and a more even distribution for various tasks. But the question I have actually relates to the fact that, strangely enough, I find it really intriguing that no one ever mentions the NSA.
Mm-hmm.
It is the most secret of our national security, organizations, and it's almost as if it doesn't exist. It's almost as if everyone is afraid to even mention that it exists.
Well, we won't be. National Security Agency, Stanfield Turner, how does it figure into all this? Remind us of its role, and how does it play into the tug of war we're talking about?
The National Security Agency is the agency that collects electronic intelligence. It listens around the world and picks up conversations, telegrams, and such forth, and therefore lets us know what other people are saying to each other. It's a very valuable agency. It is a very sensitive agency in that if other countries and other people know that their conversations and messages are being intercepted and deciphered, they won't send them anymore. So we keep it as quiet as we can.
And who rides herd there, CIA or DOD?
Now, we keep talking about CIA and DOD. It's not a question of those two butting heads. It's
okay.
A question of the director of Central Intelligence,
mm-hmm.
The overall head of the community, and he should ride herd on the NSA.
Does he?
When, in fact, the Department of Defense is riding herd on the NSA. The NSA should be operated in the national interest as represented by the director of Central Intelligence, whom, as I said, reports directly
mm-hmm.
to the president,
mm-hmm.
not in accordance with what the Secretary of Defense wants.
But here again, we've got that pendulum swinging deeper into the Pentagon's pocket. We're talking tonight about a high-stakes turf war in America's intelligence community, how it's shaping, maybe warping, America's view of the world. Are you more comfortable with the center of U.S. intelligence operations in the CIA or the Pentagon? And can any new intelligence czar be strong enough to get a grip on our sprawling intelligence apparatus? My guests tonight are Admiral Stanfield Turner, former head of the CIA, and Melvin Goodman, former CIA Soviet analyst. You can join us, too, at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a high-stakes turf war in America's intelligence community. My guests are Admiral Stanfield Turner, one-time director of Central Intelligence from 1977 to 1981, and now a senior research scholar at the Center for International and Security Studies at the University of Maryland, and Melvin Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a Soviet analyst with the CIA from 1966 to 1986. You can join the conversation as well. Can you imagine an entire intelligence community politicized to tell U.S. leaders what they want to hear? Can you imagine it another way? Are we fixing the intelligence focus that was blind to 9/11? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Melvin Goodman, it was only a couple of months ago that we heard Donald Rumsfeld was unhappy with the CIA. He wasn't getting the evidence he wanted that Iraq and Saddam Hussein were supporting international terrorism. So he set up his own intelligence squad to go after that information. It sounded odd at the time, as though it was, go out and bring me this particular scalp. Is intelligence supposed to work that way?
No, it isn't supposed to work that way. And remember, at the time that Rumsfeld criticized the CIA, he claimed that he had bulletproof evidence that the Iraqis were linked to al-Qaeda.
That we're still waiting to see, I guess.
Yes, we're waiting for that bulletproof evidence. This is a very dangerous step because what it suggests is that Rumsfeld has decided to shoot the messenger. The messenger, in this case, is the CIA, which cannot establish those links, the connecting so-called connecting tissue between Iraq and al-Qaeda. So he's creating a small group, but it's in the defense authorization for this next military budget. That means it's been approved by the Senate Armed Forces Committee, which is another problem in this turf war, because now the Senate Armed Forces Committee is heavily engaged in the intelligence community, and the Senate Select Intelligence Community, which once had oversight responsibilities but has neglected those responsibilities, and I think is partly to blame for 9/11, I might add, is becoming less of a player, because if most of the budget for the intelligence community belongs to the military, the Senate Armed Forces Committee will have most of the responsibilities in watching the performance of that community.
And so it all starts to work together. Stensfield Turner, how about George Tenet's role here? A director of Central Intelligence, you've been in his chair before. He doesn't seem to be clamoring in any public way for greater authority, for greater power. Is he too wounded post 9/11, or what's going on there?
No, I think he personally comes out pretty well in 9/11. George Tenet, as I've observed him, and I'm not very close to it, has not taken a big interest in directing the overall community. He's been very good at running the CIA and improving morale at the CIA. As a result of 9/11, however, we've uncovered the fact that the intelligence community was not sharing information adequately. The FBI wasn't talking to the CIA and vice versa and so on. So the issue today is, how are George Tenet and Donald Rumsfeld going to settle out some new system that will correct this failure to share information within the intelligence world? We cannot go forward in this struggle with terrorism without improving our intelligence capabilities so that we don't have another failure in August of 2003, let's say, as we did in August of 2001, in not putting all of those dots together in order to draw up the conclusion that somebody was going to run an airplane into the World Trade Center.
And yet I don't see the Department of Defense being eager to give up that authority. And as Melvin Goodman describes it, Congress may not be fully on the war path to get that done either.
No, that's true. The Department of Defense still has its own parochial responsibilities, and they're very important for our country. But they have been superseded in the last year and a half by 9/11 and by the fact that terrorism has become the number one threat for our country. And therefore, we must organize the intelligence world around doing the best job possible against terrorism.
And still how slowly the wheels turn. Cause is on the line. Cause, I have a note here that says this is an alias. Why? Hello, Cause, are you there? I think I've lost cause. Let's turn to Chuck calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Chuck. You're on the air.
All right. I had a question for you. I do not disagree with many of the points that have been brought up regarding the benefit of focusing the efforts avoiding the waste of money due to duplication of efforts and so on. However, there's one concern that I have, and that is a system of checks and balances. If you have a single organization, or at least organized under a single director who is in charge of all of the efforts and has a single reporting structure up to the president, the advantage we have today with a little bit of duplication is we have some checks and balances that avoid some corruption. If you have a single agency, how do you avoid the corruption of making sure that that one intelligence agency is not corrupted?
So what if the national intelligence head turns out to be a kind of J. Edgar Hoover? Chuck, thanks for your call. Melvin Goodman, how about it? Is it possible that we've got the worst system today except for all others?
No, we have a bad system. Chuck is spot on. I think you need more redundancy in the system. You used to have it in the CIA. You had three separate offices who reported different points of view on intelligence up to the director. This was certainly true when Stan Turner was director of CIA, but ever since Bill Casey was CIA director and then Bob Gates, they've consolidated and centralized. Now all the intelligence is funneled through the deputy director for intelligence, to the CIA director. And this is not the way to produce objective-minded and competitive analysis.
But I think, Chuck is concerned. I think Chuck is concerned that if we have one person, one top intelligence czar, you recreate a kind of single authority. And if that's corrupted, what happens to checks and balances? Stansfield Turner, do you share that concern?
I do, and Chuck's point is very good. But we are so far from that today, with 14 different agencies running around.
And if anything, that concentration of power is there in the Pentagon.
Yes, and so I agree we've got to be very wary of that. We've got to insist that directors of national intelligence, if we create that job, put competitive analyses on the table. Ensure, for instance, that if you put a major intelligence report out, it says the director of Central Intelligence believes the war is going to start on a Tuesday. But it then goes on and says, but the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, for the following reasons, thinks it's going to start on Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
And that differing opinion is not suppressed, but given a chance to air itself, and the reader can say, well, I really think the guy who talked about Thursday's got a good point. You see what I mean?
Yes, I do. Melvin Goodman, look at the situation today. The Pentagon has 80 to 90% of the intelligence budget, but it's the director of Central Intelligence that briefs the president every morning. So how close to true north do you think the intelligence picture being given to the White House is today? Is it way off course, or is it pretty well on?
Well, I think the danger today is that it's so clear what the policy positions of the administration are right now that I think there is a lot of pressure on the CIA director to give the president what he wants. Not the CIA analyst, but the CIA director. Now let me give you an example. Rumsfeld is trying to prove there is linkage between Iraq and al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
CIA analysts say the evidence isn't there. But George Tenet put a covering letter on a CIA memo, and he referred to links and indicators of links between Iraq and al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he did that essentially to appease the president who wants that point of view. Unlike Stan Turner, I don't give George Tenet high marks. In fact, I give him very low marks for 9/11. And I look at 1998 when the two embassies were bombed on the Horn of Africa,
mm-hmm.
and George Tenet sent a memo not only to the CIA but to all of the 14 agencies in the intelligence community to do more on terrorism. Nothing was done in the wake of that memo.
Mm-hmm.
Additional money wasn't spent. Additional personnel
wasn't put
on priority. And when you look at something very simple, something very basic, like the weaponization of commercial airliners, there were reports going back to 1994 and 1995. You had a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. You had the Congressional Reference Service.
Melvin Goodman, we're running out of time here, but it's a vivid picture we painted tonight. With those failures up against the concentration of intelligence in the Department of Defense, it's a lot still to sort out. But you've given us a big insight into the tensions there. I want to thank you for coming on tonight, Melvin Goodman.
Thank you, Tom.
Melvin Goodman is Senior Fellow at the Center for International Policy. And Admiral Stansfield Turner, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom. Pleased to be here.
Stansfield Turner was Director of the CIA from 1977 to 1981. He's a Senior Fellow at the Center for International Policy. Senior Research Scholar at the Center for International and Security Studies at the University of Maryland. You can continue this intelligence conversation online. Go to onepointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, tracking the personal history of slaves. This is On Point. In history books, American slaves are a nameless, faceless group whose impact on the nation's history is unquestionable, but whose individual lives are almost completely unknown. Tom Costa, a history professor at the University of Virginia at Wise, is trying to change that. Costa is compiling an online database of newspaper ads about runaway slaves from 18th century Virginia newspapers. The ads contain details about the slaves, which has allowed Costa to create biographies of these formerly unknown laborers. In this radio diary, he explains why he founded the Virginia Runaways Project.
When historians and the general public tend to learn about slavery, it's slaves, slavery as a very general topic with numbers given, numbers of slaves. The beauty of this project is we get to learn about these slaves as people. Enslaved persons is the term that we prefer to use. They are people. These are actual individuals with wives, children, jobs, aspirations, all sorts of things that normal people do. And of course, one of my guiding principles in this is that we want to begin to think of these slaves as we think of the other individuals in history, as individuals who are striving to work, love, all kinds of activities that people not caught up in this system would engage in. We have over 2,500 advertisements online detailing the lives of perhaps close to 3,000 individuals. And almost every one is a story in and of itself. There's one particular case of a young mulatto girl, 20 years old, who runs away in company with a convict servant, and she dresses as a boy to behave as his waiting boy. That would make him look as if he were upper class. People would be less likely to ask questions. 3 years later, she apparently had been captured. 3 years later, she's with a different owner. She runs away again, and this time she's pregnant. So this 20-year-old girl, a period in life when a lot of people don't have the kinds of experiences, young people don't have these kinds of experiences. This young lady's been through quite a bit. That's one that I always point to that really stands out. There's another case where a runaway slave with no legs, basically he has no legs below his hips, and he had a piece of leather tacked across his bottom to facilitate his movement. He runs away. Now, how on earth he could even live in that condition or how he lived is an interesting question, but then the fact that he runs away simply adds to the drama. So I could go on and on, but there are literally hundreds of these kinds of stories. One of the main misperceptions is that slaves did nothing but work in the fields. In Virginia, of course, this would be tobacco, and later on in the 19th century, in the Deep South, it would be cotton. What we found in the runaway ads is that slaves did a variety of jobs, many of them skilled, carpenters, coopers or barrel makers, shoemakers, tailors, very great number of skilled positions that slaves filled. And of course, skilled slaves, masters were more likely to advertise for them because they were more valuable. I look upon these people as if I know them. Some of them, when I read the ads, I wish I could know them. You know, historians are always talking about, boy, if we had a time machine, it could go back and see how it really was, and we are detached and objective from these things, but these runaway ads are so personal that I do feel involved in the lives of these people who, of course, are long gone. I like to think of them as people you would know. Some of them I would like to meet. Some of them perhaps you wouldn't want to meet, but the point is they are individual human beings now instead of just aggregate numbers or statistics listed in a history book.
Tom Costa is a professor of history at the University of Virginia at Wise. To view the Virginia Runaways Project, check out our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287. This is WBU.